Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is part two of our discussion of genetic testing with Dr. Michael Nova. He's Chief Science Officer of Pathway Genomics. And in part one, we talked a little bit about general concepts related to genetic testing. In part two, I'd like to concentrate on the pathway genomics test that we're now doing at the Hoffman Center, which points to specific nutritional requirements and also points to the potential for differentiating which type of diet works best for our patients. So, as a prelude, let me tell you that we have a heck of a time in the field of nutritional medicine determining what vitamins and supplements people should use. There are a couple of ways. You know, one is we, you know, listen to people and say, you know, people say, I need more energy. So we'll say, oh, yeah, well, it sounds like you need more B vitamins. Okay, we can do that way. We can also test, but blood tests are notoriously poor at yielding information about which supplements people need. So some people may have okay levels of certain supplements, but they could do with a lot more. Useful information can be garnered from genetics. Explain how that relates to people's need for more or less of certain vitamins and supplements.
Yeah, I think in general, every supplement, every micronutrient is an active compound, and what that means is it gets into your body and binds to something, and then there's an effect, or it gets into the nucleus and binds to something. And everything that these compounds bind to is usually a protein or a receptor or an enzyme, and they've all got genes that are associated with them. So what we do is we get information about, you know, those binding areas. So for example, for vitamin D binds to the, you know, the VDR receptor and the GC receptor. We look at the genes around those receptors and look at the mutations in those genes. And some people have mutations in that one particular receptor that allows them to not bind not bind vitamin D well enough. So a person like, and we give that information back in the report. So a person like that would have to take potentially more vitamin D.
Right. Well, that's really interesting because, you know, I always wonder why some patients really require such high doses of vitamin D to get by, and other patients seem to do fine on whatever's in a multi or, you know, just with a little sunlight here and there. And so initially we explained it on, you know, it's about absorption. You know, some people don't absorb things very well. Many patients say, well, do I absorb my vitamins? Well, you know, it's more complicated than that. Sometimes you absorb, but when you're talking about receptors, it means that the vitamin D has to fit like a key into a lock at some receptor site, any tissue in the body. And some people have receptors that don't hold the vitamin D very well. So you have to almost flood those receptors with high doses to make the receptors get turned on, right?
Yeah. And that's a simple and useful anecdote, which you could use for any type of micronutrient, whether it's, you know, vitamin D or vitamin C. Some of these very soluble vitamins also have transport proteins that pull the, and glucose does too, have transport proteins that pull glucose or carbohydrates or vitamin C or whatever into the cell. And these all have genes associated with the transporter. So the transporter could be faulty. So you don't have a way of getting glucose or vitamin C or whatever, you know, into the cells as well. So you need more of it or you need less of it. There might be, you know, hyperactivity.
So hypothetically, you could have a person who you do a blood test and you say, gee, the vitamin D C levels are fine. You don't need vitamin C. But you could find that their genetic tendency is to not transport that vitamin C, which is plentiful and available, to get it to where it does its job. And that gives you additional insights on whether that person needs additional doses of vitamin C.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And we talked about this earlier. One of the reasons we have physicians involved in our reports, are considered kind of state of the art. We're very fortunate to have a really strong scientific team. We're interested in using, you know, every bit of the information that's in our reports has been done in multiple clinical trials in humans. And that's a very important topic because we can look at vitamin D receptors and look at those particular SNPs, but we can only report on the stuff that was actually done in human studies. So, and that goes for every one of the micronutrients, you know, even carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, you know, have their own ways of getting into the cells, you know, have their own ways of increasing metabolism, but we can look at only the endpoints that are actually published in peer-reviewed literature.
So, you know, one of the things that I realized in looking at this is, okay, you know, I'm going to date myself. I went to med school in the late 70s and early 80s. And the blood tests that we're using in the late 70s and early 80s are virtually identical to the standard blood tests that we have now. We looked at SMAC, that's a chemistry. We looked at a CBC, and we looked at cholesterol. And maybe we weren't so concerned about HDL then, but, you know, it was known. And, you know, we're now talking 30 years later and pretty much the same tests. When it comes to this genetic stuff, the research is ongoing and it's a moving picture. And we're gaining insights virtually every month about new genetic relationships and changing our views about how certain genes influence metabolism. And so this test has got to be the test that we'll be using in 2016 will probably be a fair amount different from the test we're using in 2015, correct?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the neat thing about genetics, too, the amount of data. I don't know if you know this fact, but healthcare data at this point in time doubles every 3 years, all Yikes. Healthcare data. That's nuts, right? And by the year 2020, it'll double every 3 months. And even in my field, you know, dermatology, there's about 1,000 publications of all kinds, you know, a month. So the amount of information on top of all the it's just growing by leaps and bounds. And so we're getting so much more information about what receptor does what and what SNP does what and how it affects, you know, these big phenotypes and all this kind of stuff, that you're right. You know, the tests that we have, you know, potentially today will be modified, you know, and just have more data associated with it. But the SNPs don't change. The SNPs in your DNA doesn't change. That's immutable. That is your body's blueprint.
And by the way, that also argues for, you know, some people say, hey, you know, I just had my cholesterol checked 6 months ago. I want to see if it's better. We don't so much do this with the genetic test because it's like, that's just not going to change unless we're testing for new or different things in a couple of years. The need for repeat tests to see if you make progress. I mean, it's your genes. They're fixed.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. So, but just the amount of data and how we interpret the information is growing by leaps and bounds.
Okay, so let's get to, you know, we're talking omics. That's the big buzzword these days. And the cool new word is nutrigenomics, which is the study of how genetics influences nutrition and optimal nutrition for individuals. And we know that there's a wide gamut of how people survive on different foods, depending on their genetic, racial, national, geographical background, their sex, their age, their medical condition. Can nutrigenomics offer us a heads up on which patients to say, hey, you know, you can go on a plant-based diet versus a patient who might want to go on an Atkins-style diet?
Yeah, that's true, and it's a very exciting, you know, new field that over the last 5 years there's been a lot of development and a lot of work in. And basically, you know, we know now that your genes and diet interact. We know that for a fact. And we also know that your genes have a propensity to make you want to eat certain things. So it's kind of a two-way, you know, street. So in our pathway, the nutrigenomics or fit test, you know, we look at, you know, 55 different genes of all different types, you know, how the micronutrients get across the bloodstream, how they're picked up by the nucleus, how are you more sensitive to carbohydrates than the fats? We even what you think about food. We look at genes. There's, you know, behavioral issues about genes.
Your there's taste. Some appetite control genes and sweet craving genes and things
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. So we look at all of those to give kind of a very detailed report about how you metabolize and how you interact and how you think about food even. And that's a very, very useful test. Most of it's by far our most popular best of all the genetic tests that we produce. And it simply is because it's around diet, nutrition, exercise, micronutrients, or stuff about vitamins in there. You know, do you need to take more vitamin D? You know, are you more sensitive to, you know, increased sugar? Do you have, you know, more sensitivity to insulin? You know, it's, again, a very comprehensive type of report. And it gives you a lot of information about basically eating and exercise.
Well, let's focus on exercise for a moment. Yeah. You know, we generally say that, you know, exercise is good for everyone. Everyone should be exercising. But some people seem to get away with not much exercise. You know, like you interview a person who's 105 and you say, boy, you must have been a great athlete. And they say, nah, you know, I would take a walk here and there, but I don't like to expend too much energy. And then you have, you know, people who must exercise at high levels to maintain optimal metabolism. Does this test shed light on the impact of exercise on health?
Sure. You know, it gives you, you know, some initial information about, you know, are you a person that would respond better to an endurance type of exercise, whatever that is, you know, versus somebody that would respond better to a power type of exercise.
Well, that's great.
Response. Yeah. Yeah, when I mean response is, you know, do you get better cardiovascular efficiency or VO2 max or, you know, some of these other markers, you know, for exercise performance. And then, of course, it's all linked to, you know, the diet that you're into. You know, do you, by doing this particular exercise, do you, you know, have better response, you know, to carbohydrates or, you know, or even insulin? So there is that information in there.
So another test that is a genetic test, but it's offered usually in isolation as a single test, is the so-called MTHFR test, which looks at methylation and has to do whether you're going to do well with certain B vitamins, folic acid, B12 and B6. You can do a blood test called homocysteine, but that isn't even as sensitive as the MTHFR, which is a genetic test. Is that part of your profile?
Yeah, the MTHFR for folate and as you mentioned, for the vitamin, the particular vitamin Bs, is in the test. And I think it's in two places in the Pathway Fit test. And that is exactly right. What it's, you know, it's a measure of homocysteine. Increased homocysteine levels are felt to be, you know, kind of inflammatory and not good for an individual. And then how people process folate is really important, especially women that are, you know, potentially pregnant. And so, you know, that particular, those particular SNPs or mutations in those genes will allow you to, you know, allow the clinician to tell somebody whether they should be on more folate or not.
And it has an impact on stroke risk, dementia, yes. Alzheimer's risk, and many other factors. Yeah. So very depression risk, too, because some people are really great folate responders. Others, you know, doesn't make that much difference.
MTHFR, as you know, is one of these kind of it's in a lot of different pathways.
Yeah, methylation being, you know, you're talking about how genes are turned on or turned off, whether a gene, you know, you can have a gene, but you turn it on or turn it off by methylating it or giving it a contribution from some of these B vitamins.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm going to ask you this sort of devil's advocate question. You know, is this too much information? You know, will people be burdened by this knowledge that they're like a faulty errant 747 headed for a crash landing with all this information? Can it heighten anxiety and hypochondriasis?
No, I mean, we never get that. Maybe when we first started the company, we would, but not anymore, and especially around nutrition and diet and exercise. And some people want to do, this is stuff people do on a daily basis, and so they really want to know whether I should be eating more carbohydrates or do this exercise or, you know, eating less fats or should I be on the Mediterranean diet versus something else. We get almost an overwhelming response, you know, positive response around.
So you want to accentuate the positive, like to empower patients rather than to paralyze them with fear or undue concerns.
Right, and basically because the report basically tells them what to do. You know, you should do this to mitigate this risk, or you should eat this to, you know, help your LDLs go down. We give them that, and that's what patients really want. You know, even doctors, they want to kind of be told what to do a little bit. So our reports are very action oriented. It's just not, here's a gene, you've got this mutation in this gene, and this is what it means. We actually tell you what you should be doing with it.
Well, the challenge for we doctors who are involved in lifestyle medicine is to offer reliable information to patients. And, you're looking at a conventional blood test, it's sometimes hard to cherry pick information that is useful that patients can act upon. You know, we'll do many tests, vitamin tests and standard tests, and maybe we'll test for essential fatty acids. We'll test for, you know, different types of intestinal abnormalities which influence health. But this is I find this a really useful tool to create a narrative that can help a patient on a pathway. That's a good word, on a pathway towards good health. Could you give us a tangible example or two of a test that you've seen that's impacted the way a patient is headed?
Yeah, I mean, we did a couple of years ago, and this test is the pathway fit test, and this nutrition test has been, 100,000 people have probably taken it. We've had one incidence where we knew this one very obese, early 20s individual had never, from a very wealthy family, had never been on every weight loss trial you could possibly imagine. And he tried everything, and they finally did our pathway fit test, and in one of the sections we have a receptor that we look at. It's in the dopamine pathway, and this is kind of in your eating disinhibition, and when I start eating I can't stop. It's in that kind of pathway, and we found out he had a mutation in this pathway, and it turned out that there are certain drugs that are available that can be used to block this particular a receptor with this particular mutation, and so he was put on this this one compound, and he lost weight like a rock.
It was really
gratifying to see this, because they tried everything, every fat camp, and the poor kid was just miserable. But just this one little this one little error in this one choke point pathway, really made a huge difference. And it was a very gratifying thing to see in this young adult.
Well, one concern that has been raised in this era of genetic testing is the issue of confidentiality, because, you're gathering all this genetic information. And, let's say, you get information that someone is extraordinarily prone to overeating, or someone is extraordinarily prone to cardiovascular disease. And, you've got this vast repository of 100,000 individuals who've submitted DNA to you, and what if somebody hacks your database, or somebody leaves a laptop sitting around in a car, and the car is broken into, and all of a sudden information about thousands of individuals is on the open market to be viewed by insurance companies, the government, potential employers. How do you safeguard against that and reassure patients?
Yeah, I think a couple ways to do that. One, in the United States, we have very strong laws that protect the patient, from what's called genetic discrimination. There's a law called GINA, G-I-N-A, which was passed a couple of years ago, which makes it basically illegal to use genetic information in any format to discriminate against healthcare or discriminate against insurance coverage. It's flat out illegal.
Because that'd be a great way to, if you're going to hire an employee for 20 years or something, say, could you please give me a saliva sample, and I'll see if you're, if you're going to, be an old gray mare who's going to break down, and will be a poor investment for me to put training into.
Yeah, so you can't do that. In the U.S., it's illegal to do that. And there's the HIPAA laws to protect against patient privacy. And we have very strong privacy and security, locks, basically, if you will, on the genetic information. We've never had anybody.
So, and the insurance companies don't come to you and say, could you please send us the records on Mr. Smith? We'd like to see if, he's going to cost us a lot in the future because he's applying for a policy.
Just them asking about illegal.
Oh, okay.
They can't really even do this. So they wouldn't dare do that kind of thing. So there's a lot of, we're under a lot of scrutiny to have the data that we collect be extremely private and de-identified, so it's not even linked up with the correct user. It would be very difficult, for anybody to be able to, to get that kind of information.
Right. And of course, the same thing applies to medical records in my office.
Yes.
Whenever I get a request for medical records, which these days is less and less frequent because we don't, we don't take insurance for many of our patients. But you have to specifically authorize release of your records. Otherwise, I would be in serious trouble. So there has to be a very specific release if you want the records released. And if you don't want your records released, and we wouldn't release this information routinely, it's not going to go out anywhere. So let's sum it up. What's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? How can people get more information about Pathway Genomics and you and what's happening over there? And how can they access a health practitioner who will perform this test?
Yeah, you can on our website. You can talk to Dr. Ron here. There's a lot of different ways to do that. We have a network of thousands of providers around the United States. We have large deals with large companies, small companies, there's certainly been a lot of publicity around us lately. And so it's pretty easy to get a hold of, a way to get one of our tests if you're interested in doing that.
And what's the website, please?
It's www.pathway.com.
Pathway.com. Okay, that's simple. And if you put in Pathway Genomics into a search, you're certainly going to find it. And anything that people should be reading, do you recommend any articles or any way that people can get up to speed on this technology?
There's a lot of books. There's Your DNA Yourself. It's kind of a primer on what this whole genetics and omics business means. And there's many references. You get on Amazon, you can find a lot of them, and they're all pretty good. There's certain web based publications that I can forward to you, and are good starting points as well. But we have a list of those on our website.
Great. So there's a resource list there, and people can delve into this subject to the extent they want to. Well, fantastic. This has been very, very revelatory, because this is a science, a technology that's going to be with us in medicine increasingly in the coming years. And it holds great potential, hopefully not for abuse, but for use to guide us in the right direction in terms of not just what drugs and conventional treatments we should be getting, but in terms of our lifestyle choices, diet, exercise, supplements, to enhance our health and to provide us with a greater insight about who we are as people. And, one of the things that I constantly reiterate to patients is the trouble with being born is they don't hand you an instruction manual, and you are a very, very complex biological device. And it's for you to discover your own instruction manual. And I think that this is a tool that's going to empower a lot of people.
Yeah, everybody's different, basically.
Absolutely. And that's also the issue here is it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It emphasizes biological individuality, but it adds precision to our ability to discriminate among different types of people. So thanks very much for joining us, and congratulations on your research. And hopefully in the future, you'll keep us abreast of any future developments.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Our guest, Dr. Michael Nova of Pathway Genomics. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.